Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, challenging access to abortion in a country where Roe v. Wade still stands for now. As Anthony Kennedy leaves the U.S. Supreme Court, there are dire predictions about what will happen to Roe v. Wade. We'll talk about that with our guests. But I'm also interested in the legislative progress anti-abortion forces are making in state capitals. Remember that before Kennedy announced his retirement, the court decided last week that contrary to California law, health centers that oppose abortion do not have to inform women about the option of a free or low-cost abortion. They also don't have to inform them about contraception. It's another legal victory in a nationwide strategy by opponents of abortion to make the procedure more inaccessible. And although some state laws have been reversed by higher courts, legislators continue to come up with bills to limit access. As our guests join us to talk about the tactics and the strategies anti-abortion groups are employing, we'll open the phone lines for your calls and questions, and I'd like you to think about this. Do you believe that there are too many restrictions on access to abortion or not enough? What's your opinion informed by? Is it religious views? Is it the idea of a right to privacy? I'd like to know your thoughts on this and what influences your ideas. Do you vote on this issue? Be interesting to hear from you on that as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, and I've got a lot of comments here coming in on social media, so I'll get to some of those as well. You can join in at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Daniel K. Williams is with us. He's an associate professor of history at the University of West Georgia and the author of Defenders of the Unborn, the Pro-Life Movement Before Roe v. Wade. And he's with us today from Carrollton, Georgia. And Daniel, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Carrie.
Mary Ziegler is with us, professor of law at Florida State University and author of Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade, and the Fight for Privacy. And she's with us from Santa Rosa, Florida. And Mary, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Mary, there was a lot of, I think, hyperbolic analysis about Roe v. Wade in the wake of Kennedy's departure announcement last week. Listen to Jeff Toobin, among them, on CNN talking about how he feels Roe is endangered.
You are going to see 20 states pass laws banning abortion outright, just banning abortion, and because they know that there are now going to be 5 votes on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. And abortion will be illegal in a significant part of the United States in 18 months. There is just no doubt about that. And that's why these seats matter so much.
So, Mary, is there no doubt about that?
I think there's doubt about that. I think it's true. I've been asked, is Kennedy's departure a game changer constitutionally? And it certainly is. There was not much of a chance at all that the court's abortion jurisprudence would change fundamentally with Kennedy on the court. And that chance is certainly present now. But I think the 18-month timeline is pretty unrealistic. I think that would be pretty risky for the court from a reputational and kind of legitimacy standpoint. If there's been no buildup, no mention in precedent that Roe would be overturned, to go from that world to actually Roe's incorrect in 18 months would be kind of shocking to me. It's possible in a way that it wasn't before Kennedy's exit. But I think to say there's no doubt is hyperbolic, like you said.
Daniel, I wonder if let's put the timeline aside. Is it true that overall, among these many states that I mentioned in the introduction who are limiting access to legal abortion, will they feel freer to step in and tighten up these laws and feel like if the laws make their way through the courts, they've got a shot at prevailing at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes. I mean, it's already happening in states like Iowa, where you saw an early abortion ban passed earlier this year. So I think the question for pro-life forces is really going to be how much and how quickly. That is, do you settle for, say, a 20-week ban, as many states are already doing? Do you try what's called a heartbeat ban at 6 weeks? Or do you actually try to ban almost all abortion in the state in the hope that you could have a game-changing Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade? And I think there's going to probably be a fair amount of debate on the ground among pro-life forces about how to do that. What is the best strategy going forward? Because if you try too much too soon, you could lose everything. The very worst possible outcome for the pro-life movement would be another Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision. So in 1992, pro-life forces were very optimistic that they had 5 votes on the court to overturn Roe v. Wade, and actually didn't. And ironically, that surprise vote turned out to be Justice Anthony Kennedy, who, contrary to expectations on both sides, ended up voting to affirm most of Roe v. Wade. There was some change on the margins, but for the most part, the broad parameters of abortion legalization in the U.S. were affirmed, and that ended up setting the pro-life movement back. And so the danger would be that they could do too much too quickly. There are certainly going to be some pro-life advocates who want to do that, but I think there are others who are going to be a little more cautious.
And Mary, what Daniel just said leads me to this. Is it your sense that it's the goal of many anti-abortion activists to actually overturn Roe, or do they look around the states, as Daniel just laid out, places in Iowa and the South, and say, look, we're making a lot of progress here. Let's not go too fast too soon.
Yeah, I think if you were pro-life or anti-abortion, your goal ultimately is to ban abortion nationwide. It's not to overturn Roe, because if you believe in a right to life, allowing states to ban abortion or not doesn't really get you there. You think abortion is murder, so you want to go further. So the dream would be, you know, a Supreme Court decision recognizing, you know, fetal rights or the right to life. It wouldn't be a decision overturning Roe. But if it's risky to ask the court to overturn Roe immediately, it would be even riskier to ask the court to recognize fetal rights when there's not a lot of precedent in the short term that you can point to supporting that kind of decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think that at least among sort of mainstream, for lack of a better word, anti-abortion or pro-life groups, there's been a pretty big commitment to a kind of incremental or more cautious approach. And the kind of centerpiece of that at the moment are these 20-week fetal pain bans, partly because those draw on or resemble but go a step further than legislation the Supreme Court's already upheld. So I think you're going to see a commitment to that kind of approach from, you know, groups like Americans United for Life or National Right to Life Committee or the Susan B. Anthony List. But you might see more doubt about how slowly the anti-abortion movement needs to go, given that the court is going to be as different as it might be in a few months or years' time.
Catherine called to say, it seems strange to me that those who oppose abortion and make it more difficult for women to get them will not fund child care programs such as WIC and daycare subsidies, etc. Until the pro-abortion side links those two things, I think their argument is going to be harder to make. And then to Amy in Sioux Falls. Amy, you're a physician, is that right?
That's correct. I'm a physician in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
How are you seeing this this issue where we're at today?
Well, I'm an OBGYN in a very conservative state.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that sometimes what I need and want to do for patients and what they need from me can be limited just with the abortion restrictions we have now currently, particularly the 20-week ban. However, my biggest concern about overturning Roe v. Wade as a physician is that I am very worried that we will go back to what it was 50 years ago, where women were dying from illegal abortions. In the rest of the world where abortion is illegal, it accounts for up to a third of maternal mortality. A third of women who die in pregnancy die from illegal abortion in places where it is illegal. And I don't want to see that happen in the United States.
Daniel, if I may, Amy, Daniel's a historian on this, and I want to get his thoughts on what you said. Daniel, you wrote the book, The Pro-Life Movement Before Roe v. Wade. Does she have her analysis right on this?
Well, you know, I hesitate to argue medicine with a doctor, I guess. But what I would say from my investigation is that the death rate from illegal abortions was very high in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. It dropped rapidly after the late 1940s with the availability of antibiotics. And according to CDC numbers in the 1960s, the death rate was probably about 300 per year from illegal abortion in the 1960s. So higher certainly than it was after the legalization of abortion nationwide, significantly lower than it was in the 1930s or in parts of the world where antibiotics or modern medical care might not be fully available. I think if Roe v. Wade is overturned, what you would most likely see in the short term would actually not be a significant difference in practice, medical practice on the ground in most places. That is, right now, a disproportionately high number of abortions occur in two states, California and New York, with two others, Maryland and Florida, contributing a significant number. But once you go beyond those four states, the number of abortion clinics or abortion providers really starts to drop off quite a bit. So in the most restrictive states, like, say, Mississippi or North and South Dakota, you might have only a single abortion clinic in the state. And so I think if Roe v. Wade were repealed, the immediate effect would be that those states that are most hostile to abortion would go from, say, one abortion provider or two or three abortion providers down to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And other states where abortion is much more widely accepted would probably actually see an expansion in their abortion facilities or the number of abortion clinics.
You're speaking to something that that I was curious about. I saw an interview with Jerry Falwell Jr. in the Associated Press, and Falwell told the AP, what people don't understand is that if you overturn Roe v. Wade, all that does is give the states the right to decide whether abortion is legal or illegal. My guess is that there'd probably be less than 20 states that would make abortion illegal if given that right. You seem to be saying the same, Daniel, yes?
Yes. I actually think that
I agree with
regardless
that.
Okay. And Mary, you agree with that? You wanted to add?
Yeah, I think that the 20 number comes in part from, it comes from the Guttmacher Institute's study on this, but that includes pre-Roe bans that have been left untouched. But those are on the books in states like Massachusetts and Michigan that are not as strongly opposed to abortion and don't have as many restrictions in place as, you know, for example, Mississippi. So if Roe were overturned, you'd expect there to be a pretty intense political battle. It wouldn't just be automatic that you would see a ban in a state that's either blue or purple, like Massachusetts or Michigan.
What we'd have is then a patchwork, essentially, of states that have abortion, access to abortion or not. Is right. You'd be, if you lived in a state that didn't have that you could not get an abortion, you'd have to travel to a state that did. Is that right?
Right. And And I think, as Dan was saying, that there already is a patchwork. It's just a patchwork with respect to access.
Right.
You would have a patchwork instead with respect to legality, which is obviously a change. And I think the other thing that's probably worth saying is that we don't, from a technological or medical standpoint, live in the pre-Roe world either, especially with the spread of medication abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a black market for medication abortion in countries in Latin America where abortion is illegal. I think you would expect to see something like that here, too. So you're not talking exclusively about surgical abortions anymore in the way that you might have been in the 60s or even early 70s.
It's a really good point, Mary. I was reading about some of these cases where pharmacists are refusing to fill prescriptions for these abortion medications, including that case out of Peoria, Arizona, where the pharmacist mm-hmm. wouldn't fill the prescription the doctor, the woman's doctor, had determined that the fetus had no heartbeat. You're saying you can get that medication in countries where abortion is illegal. Maybe the black market expands here if more and more states feel free to limit access?
I think that's right, and I think it would pose interesting questions for pro-life forces, because one of the kind of long-standing commitments has been that if abortion is illegal again, that women won't be punished, only abortion providers will be, if criminal law is in play.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking at a world where medication abortion is widely available, and where in theory women are going to be buying a medication abortion on the black market and ending their pregnancies at home with no abortion provider involved, then you could have a scenario where you either have to punish women or punish no one, because those procedures or medication abortions wouldn't necessarily involve a doctor if they're taking place on the black market. So there's also a lot of interesting questions in states that will ban abortion about what exactly the law will look like after or if Roe is gone.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, taking into account that President Trump today, by the way, is talking with potential nominees for the U.S. Supreme Court. We know this, that the court will become more conservative, and there's been speculation that that will put Roe v. Wade at risk. We're talking about what's happening now with anti-abortion activists in state capitals who are succeeding in limiting access to legal abortion. But we're also talking about in a new, world order with a different U.S. Supreme Court, what would that mean for access to abortion, particularly if the court decided to take a look at Roe v. Wade again? Daniel K. Williams with us from the University of West Georgia and the author of Defenders of the Unborn. Merrick Ziegler with us from Florida State University and author of Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade and the Fight for Privacy. I'm asking you whether you believe there are too many restrictions on access to abortion or not enough. And what's your opinion informed by? Is it by your religious views, your idea of a right to privacy? Is this an issue that you vote on? Is it top of mind, maybe the first couple of issues when you're thinking about who you're going to support politically? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, where Nicholas says, "My pro-life views are informed by biology, that the creation of new human DNA is the non-arbitrary event at which human life is of value." Another listener says, "I'm very worried about my nieces and young cousins' reproductive rights. I'm motivated to defend their rights, even though they're not old enough for it to matter just yet. I'd prefer it if more money and resources were put into comprehensive sex education and contraception." Daniel, I wonder if, before we go back to the phones here real quick, I wonder if there are some other laws that pro or anti-abortion activists favor, believe, gets them further down the road towards overturning Roe v. Wade that have not been debated in state capitals. Are there some restrictive laws that you see will emerge now that the court's going to change?
Well, again, the question is whether you adopt an incremental strategy, which is more likely to be upheld by the Supreme Court, or whether you try to go for the entire jackpot, so to speak. I think that the court would be most likely, especially with this likely conservative turn, the court would be most likely to continue upholding restrictive laws at later stages of pregnancy, or in the case of particular abortion procedures, there's already a lot of precedent for that. I think there will be there'll be a strong temptation for pro-life forces to try to go for, say, an all-out abortion ban or something close to that, or a ban at 6 weeks. That would essentially force the Supreme Court's hand on Roe. And if you want to see if the court would overturn Roe, that's what you would do. You would actually try to pass a very restrictive abortion bill. As Mary already said, though, what pro-lifers would ultimately like, though there's very little chance of that passing in the immediate future, would be a nationwide declaration, ultimately a constitutional amendment, as has been what the pro-life movement has wanted since the early 1970s, but a constitutional amendment that would recognize conception as the beginning of human life and would protect life from that moment, which would, in essence, ban nearly all abortions.
But every state would have to ratify that.
There's certainly
they?
Not the popular support for that.
Wouldn't states have to ratify that?
Yes, and right now, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, Mary, you're going to
ask. So in 19...
Mary, go ahead, and then I'll come back to Daniel, and then we'll take a call.
I just was going to say, I think amending the Constitution, not just, I think, obviously, Dan's right that from just where popular opinion is on this issue, there wouldn't be support for a nationwide abortion ban. But it's worth remembering that just amending the Constitution to say pretty much anything is really challenging and hasn't been done for quite a while.
Right. Even the ERA fell short. Yeah,
exactly. So there's sort of institutional obstacles even beyond where public opinion is now on abortion.
We do have a call here, Dan, about the Constitution. How about if I take that and we can continue this to Ralph in St. Paul? Hi, Ralph. You wanted to talk about the Constitution?
Yeah, I've had this viewpoint for a while. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
My feeling is that the Constitution protects the right to abortion on the grounds of separation of church and state. Some people believe that there's a soul and that enters the body and that's your human life. But my personal feeling is that soul doesn't enter the body until after it's ready to be occupied, just the way you wouldn't move into a house until it's built.
Okay. I don't think this is the church and state issue here, Mary, is it? Isn't it the right to privacy?
Yeah, I think that Ralph is right that that's a constitutional argument that's been made and is actually coming up a little bit more often. But the Supreme Court actually rejected a church and state argument in 1980 when the court was, you know, more liberal than it's likely to be now in a case called Harris versus McRae. So I think that certainly supporters of abortion rights continue to make that argument, and they've been doing it even more ironically after the Hobby Lobby decision and the kind of resurrection of religious liberty arguments on the right. But it's still a hard argument to make. So we're mostly talking about the due process clause, the right to privacy, the 14th Amendment, not about separation of church and state, at least when it comes to Roe and its future.
Okay. To Steve in Duluth. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what do you want to say?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say that I sit on the board of the only nonprofit women's health center left in the state that isn't associated with Planned Parenthood, and we provide abortions up here in Duluth. And for us, we've seen, thankfully here in Minnesota, no new restrictions in the last at least 8 years. But we always look at the state legislature every year, and we're paying attention because we know that as an independent clinic, it gets harder and harder because the anti-choice organizations like to push bills that incrementally make it more difficult to provide abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, we see it just as a simple medical procedure. This is something between a patient and her doctor, and for myself personally, I don't quite understand why this particular medical procedure is looked at so differently than any other medical procedure that's provided every day.
Let's ask Dan Williams that. Dan, what is the heart of the thinking here that makes this different and subject to different laws and consideration?
For the pro-life movement, this has always been about human life. And I guess this gets back to the last caller's point and also to Nicole calling in about the biological argument in DNA. Really, I think the question for nearly all pro-lifers is this a human being? When does human life begin? When does human personhood begin? And if you're convinced that it begins at conception, as the vast majority of pro-lifers are, then you have this moral imperative to defend human life, that just as we have laws against infanticide, they would say, so we would have laws protecting human life at earlier stages. Now, if you don't buy that argument, as most pro-choicers do not, then this looks like unnecessary regulation. But I think if we really want to understand the pro-life side, we have to start from that fundamental premise to say, look, these are people who believe that the fetus is a full human being with the rights of personhood with constitutional protections.
Julianne says on Twitter, I am highly motivated by this issue. This current loss of reproductive rights makes me incandescent with rage. And Anita says, protecting reproductive freedom and choice is one of the top issues that I vote on. I'm a pregnant woman with two children living one miscarried pregnancy. I firmly believe it is a woman's right to choose when and how to create her family. Those listeners responding to a question that I've asked as to whether this is a motivating issue for you when you think about who you're going to support candidate-wise, and how your opinion on abortion is informed. Do you think there's too many restrictions on access to abortion, not enough? Is your view informed by religious views, this constitutional issue of privacy, the idea of when life begins? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Back to our discussion now. Mary Ziegler with us from Florida State University, author of Beyond Abortion. Dan Williams with us from University of West Georgia, author of Defenders of the Unborn. Here's Sean on Twitter, who says, I was a conservative Republican as a young voter and very anti-abortion. However, I now seem to be a Democrat because I support individual liberties, a Republican ideal, which means I need to allow others to choose to have an abortion, even if I disagree. Nathan says, I'm pro-choice, have always been, but recently found out my wife and I are expecting our first child in the fall. I'm conflicted now that I'm seeing the different growth stages and wonder if a term limit would be acceptable to other pro-choicers. Mary, I'm not sure what he means by a term limit.
I think one of the things that's interesting about this issue is that we often debate it in terms of pro-life and pro-choice. And if you look at polling data, you see that a lot of Americans don't really fit comfortably in either category.
Right.
I think he means that maybe we would keep abortion legal up until a certain point in pregnancy and make it broadly illegal thereafter, which is actually how the law works in parts of Europe.
Right.
And I think there's pretty widespread support for that. Gallup released a poll in 2018 suggesting that support for broad access to abortion declines for most Americans as pregnancy progresses. So there's a lot of, I think, listeners who may find themselves kind of in a gray area where they don't know how to feel about this issue and are not sure how the law should deal with it. And he might be one of those who fits that bill.
Dan, that's why I always wonder about the polling that comes out. And I think there's a new Gallup poll out that says Americans support abortion by a 2-to-1 margin. What else should we understand about how polling works on the issue?
First of all, the polling results will be vastly different depending on how the question is asked. And so depending on whether you're phrasing this in terms of, say, reproductive rights versus abortion, you might get slightly different results for that, or there could be other variations in the question. And so that's one of the things that makes this difficult. The other thing that I think makes it difficult is exactly what Mary was saying, which is that if there's any lesson to be learned over the polls from the last 40-plus years on abortion, it's that abortion opinion doesn't change very much over the long term. It fluctuates a little bit depending on which party is in power and whether people feel like certain rights are going to be taken away or not. But on the whole, what we have would be one group of people who are going to be strongly opposed to abortion, another group of people who are going to be very supportive of abortion rights, and then a large plurality of Americans in the middle who have views on abortion that are difficult to define. And so on the one hand, it seems that they don't want abortion to become illegal.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they're very uncomfortable with it. And so if a question is asked, say, should a woman be able to have an abortion for any reason, they would likely say no. On the other hand, if the question is asked, should abortion be available in cases of rape, they would mostly say yes. So I think that it's difficult to get at the precise parameters, because I think, as with this last caller, there's difficulty even in a person's mind in trying to figure out, okay, exactly what are the parameters in which abortion should be legal or should not be legal.
Right. And Bailey on Twitter might be another one of those voters. She says, I'm a Christian. I believe that life begins at conception, but I can't accept governments comprised of older men regulating what women are allowed to do with their bodies. To the phones to Jack in Hopkins. Hi, Jack. What are you thinking about?
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm a Christian, so thou shalt not kill. I'm a biologist, so I mean, I'm familiar with the primordial soup, and life began with little strands of DNA and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also an American, and I believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, that said, my theory, but I think that a woman ought to be able to defend herself in this event. In this case, if she's, you know, with a child, and that child and her life is in jeopardy, she should have the option to defend herself. You know, it's a difficult decision to make. And I don't think that abortion ought to be an option for birth control. That being, to me, kind of an immoral option.
But, yeah, I think you're actually representing what Dan and Mary are talking about, how... I mean, Mary, what do you hear? The ambivalence, do you hear that many Americans feel about the issue in what Jack is saying?
Yeah, I think. And I think it's also part of what you see as well is that abortion has, of course, become a major political issue. You could argue, I think, that President Trump owes his election in part to that because there were Republican voters who felt uneasy about Trump because of his past or because of some of his public statements, who really hoped that he would have the opportunity to do what he's about to do, which is nominate the potential swing vote on the Supreme Court. But because abortion's become a political issue, it's pretty hard in American politics to talk about an issue with nuance. And it's also, I think, challenging in some ways to see there are people who, for example, would consider themselves pro-life, who would also want to see a bigger social safety net for poor women so there are fewer pressures on them to end pregnancies when they don't want to.
Right.
You see on the other side people who may be kind of libertarian who would be happier if, as I think one of the listeners who was on social media was saying, more comfortable if the Republican Party were pro-choice. So I think you see in the politicization of the issue that a lot of the kind of shades of gray that people feel in their own minds are kind of lost in the political debate.
You know, Mary, I always wonder about whether these state laws like the Texas ambulatory centers and what happened with that and what's going on in Iowa, whether these laws end up getting the kind of attention that they do from state legislatures because the constituents want it or because the lawmakers are serving special interests that will, I don't know, matter to re-election and to how they're seen ultimately by their constituents. I mean, do we have citizens of these states that are saying, this is what we want, go to the state capitol and make this happen?
Yeah, I think what you see in effect is that people who believe very strongly in abortion rights or in the right to life, as one of the listeners who came in on social media say, or, you know, incandescent, right, that they're much more passionate and committed to this issue, and to, you know, seeing their views enacted in law than are people who find themselves in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, as Dan was saying, if you don't even know in your own mind what the ideal legal landscape would look like, you're not likely going to be going and lobbying every day to see that become reality. Whereas if you have absolutely no question in your own mind that your position is the only moral and constitutional one, that might be a priority for you. So I think what you're seeing in part is that lawmakers are responding to people who are a vocal and committed minority, probably on in some ways on both sides. I think the plurality, I think, and maybe even a majority of Americans find themselves in neither camp, but because they're ambivalent, they're not likely to dedicate the same amount of time and energy that
they're not going to influence
who are pro-life or pro-choice.
Right. The political debate. Suzanne says, I'm anti-abortion, but I wish we could change the narrative away from Roe v. Wade. Instead, I think we should focus on the issues that would cause a woman to feel like abortion was her only option. Will reversing Roe v. Wade really stop abortions? No. So what will? Dan, how do pro-life activists answer questions like that. And we're getting a lot of them. Well, if you are right. against abortion, then you better believe in, as Mary said, the social safety net that helps women who find themselves with an unwanted pregnancy.
And large numbers of pro-lifers once did. And I think it's interesting that we're having this conversation on Minnesota Public Radio, because Minnesota, of all states, before Roe, was a leader in that progressive version of pro-life politics, where many pro-lifers were liberal Democrats. In fact, long after Roe, many pro-lifers in Minnesota were liberal Democrats. James Oberstar, congressman from Minnesota, was one of those.
That's right.
So there was a reality 40 years ago where a lot of the people who were opposed to abortion were left of center politically and very much believed in the Great Society and favored an expanded version of prenatal health care, of an expanded welfare system for women facing crisis pregnancies and for others. But I think what happened is that the pro-life movement ended up making an alliance with the conservative wing of the Republican Party in the late 1970s and 1980s. And that was somewhat of an uneasy alliance, not necessarily a natural fit, because the pro-life movement was heavily grounded in Catholic social teaching, in a principle of really rights-based politics and an expanded state. And it merged with a political philosophy that had once actually been inclined toward the pro-choice side of the spectrum because of its libertarian leanings. But once that alliance took shape, I think the pro-life politics ended up following a trajectory that ended up being very different than its earlier incarnation.
Mary, before you have to go, one last question here from Twitter. Shelley says, how will abortion restrictions impact the in vitro fertilization industry? She says, I'm curious about how anti-abortion advocates feel about the hundreds of thousands of embryos created and destroyed for this purpose each year. Have you been able to give any thought to that?
Yeah, I have. It's interesting. So in states that do choose to ban abortion, there's going to be an interesting fight about what abortion is, because many pro-lifers, or at least some pro-lifers, think that some forms, common forms of contraception, especially chemical contraception, have abortifacient properties. And certainly with something like in vitro fertilization and what's commonly known as selective reduction, right? Sometimes doctors will implant multiple embryos in for the purpose of maximizing the odds one will come to term, and deliberately terminate some of those pregnancies along the way. Those seem to me uncontroversially to be abortions. So I think there's going to be interesting line drawing problems. Again, I think the tension for pro-life forces is going to be between getting what they want, which would be more abortions banned as quickly as possible in the service of what they see as protecting human life, versus the potential that moving too fast too soon could backfire, not just in the Supreme Court, but politically as well. In Mississippi, for example, again, a very anti-abortion state, there was an effort to pass a personhood amendment, a state amendment.
I remember.
Effectively recognizing fetal personhood. That effort failed, contrary to many people's expectations, in 2011, partly because concerns were raised about things like contraception and in vitro fertilization. So I think there's definitely a possibility that could be affected, but I think it's a politically risky move for pro-life forces.
Mary, thanks much this morning. I know you have to run. We appreciate the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mary Ziegler is a professor of law at Florida State University and the author of Beyond Abortion. Hearing a lot about contraception here on Twitter, where Kate says, I'd love to see the conversation shift to contraception, especially from those who oppose abortion. And Alicia says, effective education and access to contraception with preventing the pregnancy in the first place, thus eliminating the need for the abortion. Dan, what is the when you get to the activist part of the pro-life movement, how is contraception viewed?
It tends to be viewed very negatively, and I think here's the problem. I think on the Democratic side, the sort of center to center-left wing of the political spectrum, there's probably widespread support for initiatives that would ostensibly reduce the abortion rate by providing expanded access to contraception. And there's always bafflement on that side of the political aisle as to why the other side is not particularly interested in those things. And
yeah.
I think part of that is that Among pro-life activists, which are a minority of the population and only one segment of those who oppose abortion, that is, there are many people who are uncomfortable with abortion or even oppose abortion, but who are not necessarily part of a pro-life organization. But for those who would consider themselves pro-life activists, there's a concern with contraception for at least a couple reasons. One is, as Mary suggested in her answer, that there's some belief that some of the most popular forms of contraception actually destroy life after fertilization, and so that, that they would consider those abortifacients. And secondly, because the pro-life movement has historically been rooted in religious opposition to abortion, and certainly the pro-life movement would try to distance itself to a certain extent from that history, but nevertheless, that's a reality, and that many of the people who oppose abortion on religious grounds are also very uncomfortable with contraception, and even if they're not uncomfortable with contraception per se, they might be opposed to the way that contraception is often used outside of marriage. For that reason, most pro-life organizations have taken either a neutral or a hostile stance toward contraception.
They also tend to be uncomfortable with sex education, right? Where you're going to get information about contraception.
Right. And as the pro-life movement has become especially more evangelical Protestant in the years since 1980, so in its early years it was more heavily Catholic, but in recent years, the last 3 or 4 decades, it's been much more likely to have a strongly evangelical flavor. Many of those conservative evangelicals take very conservative views of sexuality and have historically been uncomfortable with sex education, except in more controlled circumstances.
Call here from Hannah in Minneapolis. Hi, good morning, Hannah. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
No. Hi. I'm just calling to say, as someone who has personally had an abortion and who is now a mother, I can just say that I'm extremely thankful that I had the choice to determine when I was ready. I love being a mother, and I do not regret my abortion at all.
And you come to this debate, as you say, having seen both sides of this.
Yes.
Hannah, thanks for the call. To Anna in Minneapolis. Hi, Anna. What have you been thinking about in this?
Yeah, so I just wanted to respond to one of the callers who mentioned that he is rethinking his position on abortion now that his wife is pregnant.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to raise the concern that oftentimes fetal abnormalities or genetic testing to discover that there's a condition often isn't done until later on in the pregnancy. So with the concerns about later term abortion, in cases where there's a fetal abnormality, it's often not discovered until the 20-week ultrasound, and parents would be faced with a very difficult decision about whether or not to continue with the pregnancy. And if there are any bans on abortion after the 20th week, you're taking that option away from parents when it really should be something that should be between the parent and their doctor.
Yeah, I appreciate the reminder on that. Daniel, in listening to this, it again, I think, reinforces how nuanced the issue is and why the polling often doesn't measure that very well. Can I ask you where you think the politics will be on this?
Well, I think there could be a number of possible outcomes. One of the things to remember is that before Roe v. Wade, there were a lot of different types of state laws. There were state laws that banned abortion completely, except in instances when it was considered necessary to save a woman's life. There were a number of others, about 13 states or so, that where abortion was legal for certain exceptions. That would include fetal abnormalities, medical necessity, rape and incest. And then there were 4 states before Roe that allowed for elective abortion, which is essentially the scenario that we have today. And so one of the interesting things that's going to play out is, as if it's the case that states have greater right to decide what their abortion policies might be, and that's still very much in question, but if that's the case, if there are some rollbacks to Roe, for instance, if not a complete repeal, then the question will be, what sort of laws might states adopt? And I think we're probably going to see A lot of debate about that. We're probably going to see a continued patchwork of laws. And even if Roe is not overturned, I think we're already seeing some of that. So I would say that the forecast would basically be no resolution of the debate, but continued polarization on the issue.
And one other question about this, because we hear the president and others saying, are you, or others asking, is the president asking these justices, you know, how they feel about Roe, and is it a litmus test? Is there a way for the president to understand how these potential justices would feel about overturning Roe v. Wade, the precedent of that, the complexity of it, without asking them formally whether they're willing to overturn Roe?
Yes. I mean, he's promised to select justices from a particular list that's been vetted by conservative legal advocates. And the general view on that, the general view is that nearly everyone, or probably everyone on that list, has reservations about the way that Roe was decided. Now, the real question, and this is where Senator Susan Collins's concerns come into play, is that if you have someone who is who's not very happy about Roe, but has enough concern for precedent that he or she would not vote to overturn Roe, that might be in a different category than someone who takes a more thoroughgoing, what's called an originalist view of the Constitution, where there's a belief that precedents don't matter as much as the original meaning of the Constitution, and therefore it's okay to overturn even a major precedent such as Roe. And that's where I think you might see some nuanced differences among conservative justices. It's unfortunate Mary's not here in the conversation anymore, because she could probably say a lot more about that from a legal standpoint. But I do think that there are nuances of difference between conservative justices. Those differences may not fully come out in the Senate confirmation hearings. But of course, if the court decides a major abortion case again, then obviously those differences would matter a great deal.
Dan, I really appreciate the insight. Thanks so much for the time and for the explanations here. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Dan Williams, professor of history at the University of West Georgia and author of Defenders of the Unborn.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.